Hello, it's Thursday the 18th of November and welcome to Career 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. The continuing surge in COVID-19 cases in South Korea has led to a new record high in the daily case count of almost 3,300 new infections, and the number of critically ill patients has remained over 500 as well. We'll have more in our news briefing shortly. Coming up, we have our weekly in-depth Korean Politics Digest discussing the latest from the presidential campaigns and whether President Moon will stay in his party after his term is over. And then later, once again for Explore Korea, we'll be looking at the Fill the Rhythm of Korea tourism videos after the KTO released two more episodes earlier this month. Let's begin Korea 24. South Korea reported the highest ever number of daily new COVID-19 infections on Thursday. The report comes on the day that the nation held its college entrance exams, a major annual event that literally brings air traffic to a standstill. To help us unfold the details, our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin, joins us on the line now. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jang-woo.
So, disconcerting news then, Hee-jin, as a nation, it seems, is struggling to find the right balance between returning to normal routines and capping a further spread of the virus. Can you bring us up to speed on the latest situation?
Of course. The Korea Disease Control and Prevention Agency reported 3,292 additional cases on Thursday, a record number since the nation reported its first case back in January last year. It is also the second time the daily tally topped the 3,000 mark for a second straight day after the first such run in September following the long Chuseok holiday break. This brings the country's cumulative caseload to 406,065. The number of critically ill patients remained over 500 also for a second day, but dipped slightly from Wednesday by 16 to 506. The death toll rose to 3,187 with 29 additional deaths, while the fatality rate remained at 0.78%. The capital region reported a new high for a second consecutive day of 2,583 new cases, prompting autonomous governing bodies in Seoul to issue repeated warnings to residents to adhere to social distancing guidelines.
And the concentration of infections in the metro area pushed the occupancy rate of ICU beds at hospitals to nearly 80%. Within Seoul, it has already surpassed 80%. Can you tell us more?
Yes, some 537 out of 687 beds, or 78.2%, were taken by patients with severe symptoms in the capital region as of 5 p.m. on Wednesday, according to the Health Ministry. The ratio in Seoul stood at 80.9%, while that of the surrounding Gyeonggi province and the nearby Incheon area stood at 76.4% and 72.2%, respectively. Nationwide, 63.8% of the beds were occupied. Authorities had previously warned of a spike similar to other nations that began easing restrictions. South Korea is well into its third week of beginning its transition into a life of coexisting with the virus. The government may be mulling a halt on the transition process, as health authorities said it will hold emergency assessments when the occupancy rate for critical patients surpasses 75%. Health Minister Kwon Dok-chul said in a speech in Parliament that the situation in the capital area is slightly precarious, adding that business restrictions or gathering bans could be tightened after a critical assessment. President Moon Jae-in also called for agencies to step up their coordinated efforts to contain the spread of the infections and encourage the public to apply for booster shots.
And as we reported earlier, the state-administered college entrance exams took place on Thursday at some 1,300 test sites, regardless of the surge of infections. So, Hee-jin, how did it all proceed today?
Well, more than 509,800 people sat through the grueling College Scholastic Ability Test, or CSATs, across the nation, a major annual event that literally brings air and ground traffic to a standstill. Financial markets and key businesses opened an hour later than usual to ease traffic. Commercial air traffic was suspended, while South Korean and U.S. militaries grounded flights as applicants underwent their listening comprehension test in the afternoon. The military also suspended live fire exercises throughout the day. As in previous years, police shuttled anxious students running late to test sites so they could begin their exams at 8:40 a.m. sharp. The eight-hour event tested applicants on Korean language, maths, English, Korean history, and science, and ended at 5:45 p.m. Masks, of course, were mandatory. Applicants infected with the virus and those in self-isolation sat through the test separately at COVID-19 treatment centers and hospitals and other venues across the nation. Applicants will be notified of their results on December 10th.
Let's turn to other headlines now. The U.S. State Department expressed its satisfaction with consultations between South Korea and Japan on the best way to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, but it wasn't all harmonious between the parties involved. Can you tell us more?
Yes, well, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman said in a press conference on Wednesday that the U.S. is very satisfied after a three-way meeting with her South Korean and Japanese counterparts, Choi Jong-gun and Takeo Mori, in Washington. The Deputy Secretary said the three sides discussed their shared commitment to the process. She also stressed that Washington does not harbor hostile intent towards North Korea and that it believes that diplomacy and dialogue are essential to achieving the denuclearization goal and establishing permanent peace. However, a rift between South Korea and Japan was evident as representatives from the two nations did not join Sherman in a scheduled joint press conference. Sherman said that a bilateral difference between South Korea and Japan that was unrelated to the meeting led to a change in the format of the press event. She did not elaborate.
Well, Heejin, it was apparent that Sherman was referring to protests by Mori and other top Japanese officials over a visit by South Korea's police chief to the Dokdo Islands. Can you tell us more?
Indeed. Choi and Mori clashed over the issue in Washington, ultimately resulting in the Japanese official boycotting the press event. While Mori delivered Tokyo's position regarding the recent Dokdo visit by South Korean police commissioner Kim Chang-yong, Choi also made clear that Seoul can't accept any Dokdo claim lodged by Tokyo. Still, the officials exchanged views on key bilateral issues and other items of mutual concern, as it was the first high-level meeting between the two sides since the launch of the Fumio Kishida cabinet earlier this month. Chair urged accelerated discussions on resolving a dispute over Japan's wartime forced labor and sexual slavery, to which, according to Kyoto News, Mori called for Seoul's appropriate response.
Staying on the topic of international relations, the third committee of the UN General Assembly on Wednesday adopted a resolution condemning human rights violations by North Korea, the latest of 17 such bills since 2005. Heejin?
Yes, the third committee in charge of human rights issues held a meeting at the UN headquarters in New York and passed the resolution by consensus without a vote. This year's resolution, led by European Union member states, is also almost the same as in previous years, but added calls for North Korea to cooperate with the COVID-19 vaccine global access, or COVAX facility, and relevant bodies to ensure the timely delivery and distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. The resolution will be presented to the plenary session of the UN General Assembly next month. South Korea, again, did not co-sponsor the resolution, but joined in the consensus.
And finally, the French culture minister pledged to review lending Qikji, the world's oldest existing metal-printed book made in ancient Korea for exhibitions in South Korea. Can you give us more details?
Yes, Minister Roselyne Bachelot-Narquin gave a promise after South Korean Culture Minister Hwang Yi made his request on Monday while discussing the two sides' cultural cooperation during his visit to Paris this week, according to the South Korean ministry. While the French minister was concerned about the ancient book being seized while being lent to South Korea, Hwang gave assurances that would not happen. Written by Venerable Paegun about the Zen teachings of great Buddhist priests and printed at Cheongju's Hungdeok Temple during a Goryeo Kingdom in 1377, the book was included in the UNESCO Memory of the World program in 2001 after it was confirmed as the world's oldest metalloid type in existence. It was allegedly acquired by Colin de Plancy, the first French minister to Korea, between the late 1880s to the early 1890s, and later obtained by French collector Henri Verveur at a Paris auction in 1911. Verveur donated the book to the French National Library in 1952.
We'll leave it there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
We continue on now to our weekly in-depth analysis segment, Korean Politics Digest. This week, as well as looking at the latest developments from the two main presidential campaigns, we thought we'd take a look at what lies ahead for President Moon after a senior presidential official said this week that the past practice of presidents leaving their parties towards the end or after their terms should change. To discuss these issues, we have joining us on the line now our regular guest for this segment, Affiliate Professor Kim Byung-ju from the Hankuk University of Foreign Studies. Professor, hello. Hope you've been well.
Yeah, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
We start with the latest from the presidential campaigns and the struggles, particularly the candidates from the two main parties are having in forming their election campaign committees. If we first look at the main opposition People Power Party's candidate Yoon Sung-yeol, the question has been this week whether or not Kim Jong-in, the veteran politician, would join to head his committee. We've talked about Kim before, his success in leading parties from both sides of the political aisle to key election victories in recent years. That's given him the moniker Kingmaker. And getting him on board is being seen as a key step for Yoon. But although they met on Wednesday, they still seem to have some differences, reportedly over who the committee members will be. Yoon is set to announce a list of people who will be part of the committee next week, although the announcement was due to be made today. So with all that in mind then, Professor, what do you make of the situation surrounding Yoon and Kim?
Well, overall, what we see here is the candidate, PPP candidate Yoon Sung-yeol, is trying to build a big tent, the common cause often used in U.S. politics, or united front, putting together a huge, united formation, going against the Democratic Party altogether. So for that, there are talks about, adding Choi Ho-young, for instance, one of the main figures of the centrist of the party members, party leadership in the past and so on. And also even incorporating people like Kim Byung-jun and Kim Han-gil, some of the progressive, the strategists that have helped the progressive party in the past, like Nomian's party, and then the other, previous governments as well, drawing in the brains and strategists from the progressive side, from the left side as well. So overall, what Yoon Sung-yeol is trying to form is a very, very broad team, broad spectrum, team of very broad spectrum here. And, Kim Jong-un is opposing that for obvious reasons. Looks like Kim Jong-un wants to play out what he can in terms of his contribution of making this presidential election a win or victory for PPP, the opposition party. And in doing so, as the main strategists, if there are big name in Korea, what we call big heads, coming in from all around this political spectrum, of course, it will make Kim Jong-un's decision more difficult as the main control tower of the campaign strategizing and so on. So it's an obvious opposition from Kim Jong-un, but at the same time, very obvious, no-nonsense, making full sense, actually, strategy from Yoon Suk-yeol as the party candidate to introduce a very broad, wide spectrum of front lines. So looks like this is a fight or disagreements that needs to be worked out, but disagreements that was obvious from the beginning. However, for those people who would like to see the victory of PPP, probably see this kind of infighting or at least disagreement inside PPP as something very, very unfortunate because, you know, the party has only about 4 months to go, and this is not a time to dispute over who should be in, who should be out, or whatever. Rather, they should quickly put together and go ahead with introducing their own strategy and pushing forward. So this is a power game, basically, you know, like who's going to exercise great influence or power or overall. So in that sense, this is a minus point in the eyes of the voters. Voters would not like what's happening between the disagreement between Yoon Suk-yeol and Kim Jong-un.
Right. How important is it for Yoon to have Kim in his camp? Or to put it another way, how much of a blow will it be to Yoon's credibility if Kim does not come on board?
If Kim Jong-un gives up at the end, saying, "Hey, I'm not going to come on board," that will be definitely a strong loss. Not only because Kim Jong-un is such a well-known brain, as you discussed in this program of his past, his career stretches all the way back to Notaeus period, 1990s, early 1990s, when he actually is the one who wrote in the Gyeongjae Minjwa, the democratization of the economy as a whole into the Korea's current constitution. So he has been in this politics since then, and then he's the one who actually led the victory of both parties on both sides several times, being most recent one being just this April by-election of the local elections of, you know, like this whole mayor and Busan mayor as well. So he is a big name, and if Yoon Suk-yeol loses this big name, Kim Jong-un, of course, political loss will be very big. So we can see Yoon Suk-yeol's desire to include Kim Jong-un together with big names from all parts of the political spectrum. So his desire is obviously understandable. And as we hear big names like Lee Hae-chan joining possibly as the top control tower on the other side, the opposite side, the Democratic Party, you know, symbolically as well, having Kim Jong-un leading this front would be important. But practically speaking, whether it will be doable or not, considering Kim Jong-un's style, he wants to be fully in control. He wants to be able to appoint people to different positions and so on. So he wants to play out his own game, and he wants to receive full credit for it. That's Kim Jong-un's style. But Yoon Suk-yeol is seeking for more kind of reconciliatory, broad spectrum. So those two approaches seem to be colliding against one another at this point.
Well, we will, along with the rest of the Korean political world, watch whether Kim does indeed join Yoon's camp or not in the coming days. Meanwhile, as you said, the ruling Democratic Party, they've also been tussling amongst each other over Lee Jae-myung's election committee. And we were going to be talking about how he was pressuring the government to provide more COVID-19 disaster relief funds to all residents as one of the key issues today. But suddenly, just a few hours ago, he announced that he decided to drop the idea of more relief payouts. He said he won't push for any more in the face of opposition from the opposition parties and difficulties over the budget for the government. He said that if an agreement on universal payouts cannot be reached, then at least we should do everything we can to help small business owners who are struggling right now. So quite a step back by Yi. Professor, what do you make of this development?
Well, the thing is basically, you know, as you mentioned, this was one of the key issues that, you know, showed the differences between Lee Jae-myung on the one hand and then Moon Jae-in government on the other. Indeed, there's no question about it, along with the other issues, such as issues of the youth and you know, the most pressing one being perhaps the real estate issue. Lee Jae-myung even demanded apologies to be made about real estate issue. But most recently, as you mentioned, this disaster relief was a really pressing issue. And the party that Lee Jae-myung has now leads as the main candidate, the party was pressing for the 국정조사, national investigation on the finance ministry that has miscalculated the surplus tax revenue, which reaches now to 19 trillion won. So, you know, the tension was rising and it was reaching to a very, very risky, shaky point where the ruling party on one hand and the current government should not really diverge too much further beyond. And so I guess the reason why they came up with this decision is managing the situation, the divergence between the current Moon government on one hand and the ruling party led by Lee Jae-myung. But also, I think, you know, in terms of political calculation and strategizing, we have to say that Lee Jae-myung's biggest liability in his campaign so far has been the disaster relief, you know, campaign pledge. Because Lee Jae-myung initially thought it would be a best-selling package that he could offer to the public. But as this main round of presidential competition began, beyond party competition, I think the large segment of public has been taking the proposal for disaster relief as some kind of, you know, especially as the opposition labeled it kind of like a vote buying.
Right,
Lee Jae-myung is offering
policy.
All this money, right, to the people, and he's asking people to vote for him, you know, voting for that money. So it was indeed, it has turned out to be biggest political liability. So I think Lee Jae-myung probably strategically speaking made a correct decision of shedding off the biggest political liability in a manner that's very Lee Jae-myung brand, very quick, very decisive, and making a big impact. I think this decision probably will make considerable impact in terms of making the centrist voters rethink about the viability of Lee Jae-myung presidency, if you will, because he is showing to the people that he will make bold decisions, giving up even the most cherished promises he can offer to the people. So maybe that's what he has in mind in making this decision. And we'll have to wait and see whether that decision or that calculation makes the intent, brings the intended result. But Lee Jae-myung had a clear mind, a clear idea about what this bold decision should bring as a result of it. So many eyes will be closely watching whether it will bring to him the intended result or not.
Right. We'll see whether the criticism that Yi's policies were perhaps too populist, whether that criticism does ease in the coming days, and how this decision perhaps could affect his poll numbers as well, which has been suffering in recent weeks. Now, despite Yi's U-turn on the relief payouts, tensions with the current Moon Jae-in administration and those of the pro-Moon faction in the party remain. And that has also raised a question about President Moon's role after his term ends. Historically, past South Korean presidents withdrew from their respective parties either during or after their times in office, mostly in the last years of their terms. This is due to various reasons, from presidents being involved in bribery scandals and falling approval ratings to falling foul of rising factions in the party. The presidential office's senior political affairs secretary, Yi Tae-ri, talked about this in a radio interview this week, and he said this was a bad custom or practice and that for responsible politics, the president should be staying in the party. So what do you make of these statements? What do you make of this past practice of presidents leaving their parties? And do you think Moon will stay in the party, particularly if Lee Jae-myung does go on and win the election next year, as his policies seem to clash with Moon's quite a bit?
Right. I think there are two different dimensions in answering this question. And first dimension is the question of whether there is any possibility for President Moon Jae-in to leave his party before his departure as the president. And we see, everyone will agree that there will be near zero possibility for that because he's enjoying a poll numbers, support, approval for his performance, relatively speaking. Of course, the number has come down so dramatically over the past 5 years from compared to his beginning of his term, but number has come down big time. But still, if you compare his current poll numbers with previous presidents at about this time remaining in their terms, Moon Jae-in enjoys a very high level of support, relatively speaking. So for that reason, Moon Jae-in probably will join Lee Myung-bak as the second president ever who will not leave his party before his presidential term ends, which means ever since 1987, with an exception of Lee Myung-bak, exceptions Lee Myung-bak and Moon Jae-in, all presidents, as you mentioned, have left their party even before they stepped down as the president. And this, of course, as you have mentioned, is you know, having to do with the scandals and so on. But also, a big part of it is the presidential candidate who's running for their campaign for the next term. From the ruling party, they have to differentiate themselves from the sitting president because people want political change. Will that political change come in the form of the opposition party coming into the next ruling party or the current ruling party staying in power or not? There are two different questions. But the second one, in order for the ruling party to stay in, they have to still offer a very, very different kind of, as much as possible, to the extent possible, you know, different kinds of ideas and policies. And in introducing different ideas and policies, they have to negate the existing policies and the existing record of the president. So that's why we've seen all these practices so far, with an exception of Lee Myung-bak. But the Moon Jae-in will probably will join Lee Myung-bak as the second president. But the second dimension of answering this question, will Moon Jae-in stay with the party even after he resigns as the president, after his term ends? I guess that's no one can guess about that at this point. You know, it's anyone's guess at this time. And whether the party will remain loyal to or sympathetic towards Moon Jae-in's thinking and Moon Jae-in's supporters, key members, pro-Moon Jae-in members or not, that will be that needs to be watched going forward. But if Lee Jae-myung becomes the next president, of course the party will go along his way, and most likely the ruling party will change its face and the touch and smell of it altogether. So the pro-Moon Jae-in people will feel alienated, and so there will be a considerable chance that Moon Jae-in, together with his loyalists, may leave the party. But we'll have to wait and see. And if he doesn't, I think he will set another record, as you mentioned, the first time ever former president who stays with the party until the end, his biological lifetime, who knows? But anyway, you know, it will be the first case that we'll see that, because Lee Myung-bak himself left as the former president after about 4 years after he resigned from the president. He did leave the party. So we'll have to wait and see whether this new record will be set after years after the Moon's departure.
Do you think he should stay? Is that the practice that we should be seeing more of when we talk
Absolutely.
About this? Because shouldn't there be continuity? Even if presidents change, shouldn't there be continuity in long-term planning?
Absolutely. Well, I want to see that tradition being established anew. for the first time, because that means the stability of the politics and, you know, the continuity of the politics as a whole. So that's a new chapter that Korea needs, and that we need to move on to the new chapter. So my personal hope is Moon Jae-in to become the first case establishing or opening that new chapter for sure about that. Yeah.
We'll leave it there for this week's Korean Politics Digest. Professor, as always, we appreciate your insights, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 15.04 points or 0.51% on Thursday, closing the day at 2,947.38. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ, however, rose 1.51 points or 0.15% to close at 1,032.77. On the foreign exchange, the local currency strengthened 2.1 won against the dollar, ending the day at 1,180.4 won. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
Next up, it's Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the other news stories and headlines that have been looked up online by people in Korea today. And for that, our contributor Jung Yeowon has joined us in the studio once again. Yeowon, hello. It's great to see you.
Hello.
So what topics have you brought for us today?
First, we'll be talking about how starting from next year, the government will expand the amount of financial support for medical service fees related to pregnancy and birth. Then we'll learn about the two new incoming leaders of the nation's largest internet portal. And lastly, we'll delve into streaming service Netflix's decision to increase the fee of its subscription plans in South Korea.
Okay, so let's begin with our first story then. More financial support for pregnant women. Can you tell us more?
Yes. On Thursday, the Ministry of Health and Welfare and the National Health Insurance Service made an announcement that pregnancy and childbirth support will be expanded in its amount, as well as the time and scope it can be used for. Such amendments containing the aforementioned changes will come into effect from January 1st of next year.
I see. So currently, the government already gives out financial support for pregnant women and their medical bills in Korea, but that is being expanded starting from next year. Let's break down these revisions then, Yeowon, starting with the amount.
Yes. First, for mothers with one child, support for pregnancy and childbirth treatment costs will increase from 600,000 won to 1 million won, which is about $850. And for mothers with two or more children, the support fee will increase from 1 million won to 1.4 million won, which is almost $1,200. Also, pregnant individuals living in areas that have less access to hospitals and medical centers will receive an additional 200,000 won. Next, the period of use of the aid will be extended from 1 year to 2 years after the date of birth. And this also applies to those who have suffered a miscarriage or other complications. And for the scope in which the support can be used, currently it only applies for medical expenses related to pregnancy and childbirth. But these restrictions will be removed and support will be applicable for all and any medical expenses during the allotted time period. In addition, medical expenses for infants and as well as the purchase of medicine and treatment are currently supported only for those under the age of one, but this will be extended for children under the age of two.
Okay, so more money that can be used for longer and more flexibly as well. This is, of course, all in efforts to ease the financial burden on having children, a key factor that is said to be contributing to South Korea's drastically falling birth rate. So how can people sign up for this support then?
Expectant mothers or a legal representative of an infant under the age of one must get a doctor's confirmation on the application form or submit their pregnancy and childbirth confirmation receipt from a medical institution to the official website of the National Health Insurance Service. Expectant mothers also have the option to apply for the support by visiting their credit card company, a bank, the National Health Insurance Service, or by phone or website. They will then receive the support in the form of a voucher stored on a credit or debit card.
Okay, let's move on then. What's our next trending story for the day?
South Korea's leading internet portal, Naver Corporation, has nominated Choi Soo-yeon, the current director of the tech giant's global business support, to become its next CEO. The announcement follows a board meeting that was held on Wednesday afternoon. And to tell you some more about Choi, she graduated from Seoul National University's Department of Earth and Environmental Systems Engineering. She then joined Naver's predecessor, NHN, and went on to graduate from Yonsei University Law School and Harvard Law School and obtained her New York State Bar license.
Okay, so Choi replaces Han Sung-suk, who was also a female CEO, something that is rare still in Korean companies. But what's interesting is that Choi is quite a bit younger, barely 40 this year, and so she is being dubbed the millennial CEO. Despite her young age, though, she has quite an impressive CV, as you listed just there. Mm-hmm. But what did Naver say about why they chose Choi?
The tech giant said they highly valued her problem-solving ability, her support in the company's global business strategy, and a broad understanding of the market, which she demonstrated while supporting her various domestic and overseas businesses. That wasn't the only major nomination that occurred during the board meeting. Kim Nam-sun, who had been in charge of investments and M&A, was chosen as the next chief financial officer. And after joining Naver in August last year, he led big deals such as recent acquisition of Wattpad, an online social storytelling platform, and the exchange of shares with E-Mart and Shinsegae.
Yes, and he's in his 40s as well, so it's a relatively youthful new look set to lead the company. What changes are they expected to bring?
Internally, it is said that Choi intends to strengthen internal solidarity through communication with the MZ generation. She will also lead the tech giant's new task force that will be in charge of restructuring the organization that will focus more on global business, which is right up her alley. Choi will replace current CEO Han Sung-suk following the firm's general stockholders meeting slated for next March.
Yes, yeah, so a major refresh for one of Korea's biggest internet companies, coming at a time when the government has started tightening control over big tech companies and their aggressive expansions. Choi will be tasked with helping the company navigate through those challenges and grow their international business as well. Okay, moving on, what's our last story for the day, Yeowon?
Online video streaming service Netflix will be raising the rate of their subscription plans for the first time in 5 years since entering the South Korean market. The fee increase will apply for new subscribers starting today. Meanwhile, the service will notify existing members of the adjustment via email and through notification via app 30 days before the fee increase, which is also their monthly bill.
Right, so how much of an increase are we talking about here?
So the monthly fees have changed as follows. The premium plan increased by 17.2%, the standard plan by 12.5%, while the basic plan will remain at 9,501. So if you do the math, if you're a premium user, you will now have to pay 17,000 won, which is over $14 per month, and 13,500 won, which is just a little under $12 if you're a standard user. In addition, the idea of a rate adjustment has been brought up repeatedly here, but this is the first time it has actually been raised since making its foray into South Korea in January 2016.
I see. So what has the company said on what's behind this price hike?
Well, the online streaming service said that first, there has never been a price increase in the South Korean market, and second, they must maintain their service through content investment. You see, in a situation where competition in the OTT market is intensifying, differentiated content is needed, thus an increase in subscription fee is inevitable, according to them.
Yeah, so this is the first rate hike in almost 6 years, and it's said to follow rate hikes in other markets as well, but it does also come at a time when it's in legal battles with local network providers over the network usage fee as well. The company has been criticized for profiting off Korean customers and content while free riding on South Korean networks. Although the company denies that the rate hike has anything to do with that, it is rather perhaps unfortunate timing. But anyway, Netflix users in Korea can expect to see their subscription bills going up soon. Mm-hmm. That's all for Korea Trending today. Yeowon, thank you for bringing us those stories, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you. See you then.
It's time. time for our weekly segment, Explore Korea, where we journey across the peninsula, discovering more about the country's history, culture, and travel hotspots. This week, we have our travel contributor, Hannah Roberts, with us back in the studio. Hannah, welcome back. It's great to have you with us again.
Always happy to be here.
Now, in September and October, you and our other travel contributor, Ali, introduced 8 videos included in the season 2 of the Feel the Rhythm of Korea video series produced by the Korea Tourism Organization. Well, the KTO recently released 2 more, introducing Jeonju and Mokpo. So we'll be talking about them this week. And to start, we should point out that these 2 latest videos now have a new campaign slogan. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, that's right. The slogan before was Meet You Soon, but it has been changed to Meet You Now. And that's because Korea has begun its slow and careful move towards living with COVID-19, which is the name of the government's plan to lift restrictions on everyday activities and travel. And alongside that, they've actually recently opened a travel bubble with Singapore, which is giving us hope that the same will happen for other countries soon too.
Right, so from Meet You Soon to Meet You Now, a bold statement by the KTO that the country is ready to welcome back travellers. Okay, so let's talk more specifically about the videos then. So the cities of Jeonju and Mokpo are featured. Now, these were 2 locations that was actually covered in the first season of Feel the Rhythm of Korea
series
last year, but they are introducing some new locations and elements. And these songs are new as well, of course.
Mm-hmm.
One of the key points about all of these videos, especially season 2, is how they use music, taking traditional Korean songs and repackaging them into modern hits. So let's talk about the Jeonju episode first. What song was the inspiration for this video?
So this video was inspired by the song Taepyeonga, which in English is usually translated into the Song of Peace and Prosperity. It's a song about Chinese emperors whose reigns were peaceful and thriving. And so it represents the Korean people's hope and wishes also to live a peaceful and successful life like their ancestors did.
Mm.
The hip-hop version made for the video is written and performed by the rapper Wonstein, and it combines the lyrics of the original folk song with new lyrics of kind of romance or attraction between 2 people. And something I particularly like is that it uses the lyrics of the old song quite a lot. The only parts of the new song that are repeated are the parts that are taken from the original Taepyeonga.
Sure. So another great song to go along with this video presenting Jeonju, a city located in North Cholla province that is well known for its hanok villages and other traditional locations. And they are heavily featured in the video with foreign actors / models wearing hanbok, playing different Korean traditional games such as Noltigi, Gonginori and Mugunga Gochi Piyasseumnida, which was, of course, made famous most recently by the hit series Squid Game. So while all that is going on, Hannah, which sites are featured here?
So keeping with tradition, like you said, traditions of Korea and also traditions of travellers visiting Jeonju, they do recommend that we visit the Jeonju Hanok village.
Mm.
But particularly they show us the Gyeonggi-jeon Shrine, which is, it takes up actually 1/5 of the space of the entire Jeonju Hanok village. It was home to the history archives in Korea. It was built in the 1400s, just soon after the Joseon dynasty was founded. And it actually houses the official portrait of King Taejol, who was the founder of Joseon.
Right, so a lot of significance there. What else is shown in the video?
Also in the Hanok village, there is Hagindang, which is the oldest hanok in the Hanok village, built in 1908. And it was actually constructed by the same master builder that had a hand in building the royal palaces. So you can stay overnight there and experience their traditional upper-class breakfast and tea time. Or if your budget doesn't stretch that far, you can just visit and take part in like a cultural craft activity.
Excellent. So that's in the Hanok village. But I understand there are sites that are outside of the Hanok village that are featured in the video as well.
That's right. On the other side of the city, you can go to the Korea Expressway Corporation Arboretum. But that's a bit of a mouthful. So they also just call it the Jeonju Arboretum. It is a public arboretum, which means it's free to enter. But what I find really interesting about it is as its name shows, it was built to restore the environment that was destroyed by the construction of the nearby expressway.
Mm.
It's a great place to visit all year round. You can see the tulips in the spring, the roses in the summer. But among other plants, there is a beautiful bamboo forest that is there all year round.
Wow. So it was originally a nearby expressway that they've repurposed into this arboretum then, you're saying?
So the expressway was built nearby the land where this arboretum currently is.
Mm.
And as the environment was damaged by the construction of the expressway, they turned it into an arboretum to restore that land.
Fascinating. I understand there's also a location that's not in Jeonju that's also featured, that's nearby though.
That's right. It's in the nearby county of Wanju, and it's called Awon Museum and Hotel. It's a hanok resort which is located inside a 250-year-old hanok. And underneath the hanok, there's actually an art gallery that the public can enter for 10,000 won.
Right, of course. Okay, so various sites that showcase some of Jeonju's most popular and significant tourist locations and more, it seems. Let's move on to the Mokpo episode, which has a very different feel to it. First, let's talk about the song. What can you tell us about it?
So the first thing I want to say about this song is that it really suits the city of Mokpo, in my opinion.
Mm.
It's called Pungnyeonga, and it's a folk song. And in the song, they sing about kind of bringing in a bountiful harvest and celebrating and being thankful for that harvest, but also then celebrating the next spring when it comes. The hip-hop version is written and performed by Mami Som, and the lyrics of their version tell us about kind of having a good time in Mokpo, how to have that good time in Mokpo. they talk about escaping the busyness of the city and relaxing and kind of feeling the ocean air and slowness of Mokpo.
Right, so very much a love letter to the city, I would say.
Yes.
So to give it a little more info about Mokpo, it's a port city located in South Cholla province, located at the southwestern tip of the peninsula. With that in mind, what can you tell us about the locations featured in this episode, especially with how it compares to the video from season one?
The last year, they introduced us to a lot of historic spots and places that would be really popular for tourists to go to.
Mm.
But this year, they mainly focus on the fishing industry and the famous seafood of Mokpo and how people enjoy themselves there and get involved in that. The most striking location in the video is Suhyop Fishery Auction Market. I wouldn't really recommend it for tourists to go to, but if you do want to get involved in that seafood yourself, you can go to Cheongho Market or the Mokpo Port Pocha area. So if you want to take a look at the fresh catch of the day or you want to actually buy some yourself, you can go to the market. But if you want to just, if you're a bit of a foodie and you want to get involved in the gastronomy of Mokpo,
sure,
you can go to those pocha, which are small tent bars. They're actually temporary, even though they don't seem it. And they're all over the country and they're really great places to relax in a comfortable atmosphere and eat and drink until you can't anymore.
Right. Definitely much more of a local feel,
yes,
in these tents. And the whole vibe of the video as well, it's much more of a local feel rather than something of like a tourism, typical tourism video that you might find.
Definitely.
There are some more other beautiful sites that this video introduces as well, though, right?
Yeah, there's somewhere that we've actually talked about before, and that's Purple Island, Panmuldo. And they also show us Mokpo Daegyo, which is the big bridge in Mokpo Harbour, and Mokpo Coast. And all these locations kind of come back to the beauty of Mokpo and the surrounding area and how to enjoy yourself there.
Sure, it definitely a great showcase of the site, but the video definitely makes me want to go down and try some fresh seafood in Kansoju more than anything. Right, we have to wrap up, but for any listeners who want to check out the videos, you can just search for Feel the Rhythm of Korea. And to specifically see today's videos, add Jeonju and Mokpo to that search as well. Hannah, thank you for coming in today and telling us all about these videos and locations. And we'll see you again next time for Explore Korea.
See you again.
My name is Son Tae-jin. You're now listening to Korea 24.
We finish up the show as usual with our closing segment, Morning Edition Preview, looking at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's English language newspapers here in Korea. And for that, we have joining us in the studio now our staff editor, Mark Wilson Chair. Mark, it's great to see you.
Good to be here.
So where are we headed to first?
That would be to the People's section in tomorrow's Korea Times, as Kim Yeon-bin writes about the latest recipient of the LG Humanitarian Award. We've actually talked about this award before and the incredible displays of bravery and sacrifice that the recipients have done for the greater good, both socially and nationally. Mm. Kim writes about Kim Min-sung, a Daegu metropolitan city worker who saw the signs of an imminent ceiling collapse and safely evacuated people out of harm's way just in the nick of time.
Okay, so you're saying that this worker actually spotted signs that the ceiling was going to collapse just moments before it actually happened.
That's right. Last September, Kim was visiting a large meat distribution center, and that's when he detected that the ceiling was going to buckle and fall. He helped evacuate 20 people who were inside, a situation, the paper says, that really could have turned deadly. Kim even incurred injuries himself while helping these people escape. Now get this, Kim said that the accident occurred just 3 to 4 minutes after he noticed the first crack. The award ceremony was held last week, and the Daegu mayor himself was there to express gratitude on behalf of the city.
Yes, well, that's a great story indeed. And I do like these humanitarian award stories that we cover every once in a while on a Morning Edition Preview. Rare feel-good stories that we can all appreciate. Let's move on to our second story now. What do you have for us next?
We head to the Korea Herald's Weekender as Im Hyun-soo talks about the change in direction of cafes and convenience stores, both moving away from human staff. In fact, writes Im, at the annual Seoul International Cafe Show, which took place earlier this month, automation and smart devices were all the rage, from touchscreens to robotic baristas. Im continues by writing about how staff-free stores have been popping up around the country amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Jung-ho, have you ever been to any of these staff-free shops or stores?
Yes, I have. Before, when I used to live in my old place, there used to be an ice cream store that had no staff involved in it at all. And actually, there are a lot of these stores that are popping up all over the city, aren't there?
That's a good point. Now, there are many such individual shops like the ice cream store you just talked about. But Im writes that there are nearly 1,700 hybrid stores between what I would say are the big four of local convenience. Mm. Now, hybrid stores are those that rotate between human staff and not human staff? Unstaffed, right? Mm. Solely relying on self-checkout systems. But I know what you're thinking, and I think a lot of listeners are thinking this too. For staff-free stores to last long-term, they're going to need to tackle issues such as security, and experts agree. Experts also agree that it could be tough for some customers to shop there, right? While many customers are tech-capable in an aging population, there are many who just aren't, right? Now, experts are also saying that in a contactless age, accelerated by the pandemic, the demand for staff-free businesses will only grow beyond just convenience stores and cafes. Mm. Now, to read more about how this would affect the job market, which is super interesting, you need to pick up tomorrow's Herald.
Sure, that is a side effect that will be interesting to look at it as well. I do think it is perhaps more possible in Korea because of its low crime rates and its generally more tech-savvy population. But whether it's a viable long-term, that is something I guess we'll have to see. We'll leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we will talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's where we wrap up our show for today as well. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and as always, thank you for listening. Goodbye.